It's Friday, the 5th of April, and this is your Capital Economics Weekly Briefing. You may have noticed I'm not David O'Neill. They're out this week. I'm William Jackson, Chief EM Economist here at Capital Economics, and we've taken over this week's podcast to talk about some of the key issues facing the emerging world. So coming up, new tools to identify financial risks across EMs. But first, emerging markets and the green transition. Climate change is described as the global macro risk of the 21st century, and emerging market economies are seen as very much in the firing line. But there's far more to it than that. Shilin Shah, who's a deputy chief EM economist here at Capital Economics, has just completed in-depth analysis which shows how EMs will fare in the green transition, and he joins me now to discuss his findings. Hi, Shilin, how are you?
Hi, William. Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So you recently authored this in-depth piece on the green transition in emerging markets. Can you talk us through how you're thinking about what it means for the emerging world?
Yes, sure. So there's lots of analysis already out there on the green transition, but what we felt really was missing is a simple framework to help investors think about the macroeconomic impact on emerging markets of global efforts to decarbonize. And our analysis really tries to fill that gap. So we considered three parts of the process. First, we explored the impact of the shift away from fossil fuels on both emerging market producers and consumers. We then identified which EMs could benefit from increased demand for the raw materials that are needed to develop green technologies. And finally, we assessed which EMs are well placed to move up the value chain by refining and manufacturing the equipment that's going to be used in the green economy.
And so let's talk through this a bit. What are the findings of that first stage? Who's exposed to lower fossil fuel demand?
Well, it's probably not that surprising to find that several countries in the Gulf will be negatively impacted by a fall in demand for fossil fuels. For many in the region, net energy exports stand at about 30 to 70% of GDP. And there are some others that look vulnerable too, such as Angola, Nigeria, Colombia, and of course, Russia. But really, some EM oil and gas producers are better placed than others to deal with the disruption that the green transition is going to cause to the energy market. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, for example, oil and gas extraction in the Gulf is exceedingly low cost, so that even while demand and prices fall, we think that producers there will still be able to turn a profit and increase their market share. The Gulf also typically has large sovereign wealth funds too that can be used to fund investment into new industries and sectors. Saudi's Vision 2030 is one high-profile example of this. But some other net energy exporters haven't saved their windfalls. And I think the most egregious in that regard are Nigeria, Angola, and Colombia. They all have pretty small sovereign wealth funds. They already tend to run quite large budget and current account deficits. And we think that the green transition is only going to add to their challenges.
Let's move on to that second stage you described. How are you thinking about the mining of critical raw materials?
So what we did here was identify the raw materials that are most critical and look at the largest producers of them. And the ones that stood out were South Africa, which is a big producer of platinum, the Democratic Republic of Congo, which produces about 70% of the world's cobalt. Chile also stands out because it produces vast amounts of copper and lithium, which are important inputs into batteries for electric vehicles. And there's Indonesia too, which is the world's major nickel producer. But where the story in some ways gets more interesting, I think, is thinking about the countries that have endowments of materials or minerals, but they aren't yet being fully exploited. So Brazil, for example, has nickel deposits almost as large as Indonesia. Vietnam has very large deposits of rare earths. But historically, these have been uneconomical to mine, but the calculus changes as countries rush to secure supplies. And the geopolitical backdrop is going to play a big role in the process, we think. So as the global economy continues to fragment and coalesce into competing blocks centered on the US and China, the push to secure resources may occur at a very rapid speed. And actually, stepping back, it becomes quite clear that geopolitics looms large over much of the green transition process. It's well known, for example, that China has heavy involvement in mining in countries such as the Democratic Republic of Congo and Indonesia.
I think one of the really important points as we're thinking about whether EMs will benefit, whether they'll use the green transition to see incomes converge, is whether they can move up the value chain here. It's not just exploiting the mineral deposits, but actually refining them and so on. And you alluded to that earlier. How do you see that developing? And do you think the geopolitics that you mentioned earlier, there will be key in how it develops?
Yes, very much so. So given its dominance across the green technology supply chain, it comes as little surprise to find that China dominates in manufacturing too. So for example, it accounts for the lion's share of global solar panel production. That's largely thanks to the authorities' strategic efforts to capture the market. And China is also the major player in electric vehicles. It now accounts for over 70% of global sales of EVs. But there are others that could benefit too, and geopolitics will again be central in determining who those will be. And I think there's two buckets of countries to pinpoint here. So the first are those that could benefit from increased investment from Western economies wanting to seek alternatives to suppliers to China of green technology. This is part of the process known as friendshoring. Really driving this is the fear among Western economies that China will try to leverage its domination of the supply of green technology for political ends. So we think that India, parts of Southeast Asia, such as the Philippines and Vietnam, are probably the best place candidates to benefit. And Mexico stands out too. Although the nearshoring hype is probably a bit overdone, one area that we think it could do well in is in producing electric vehicles. So Tesla, for example, is planning to open a factory in Monterrey. Now, the second bucket of countries are those that are well-placed to develop green technology but straddle the political divide, so they can essentially play both sides off each other. And North Africa is an area that stood out to us. Countries across the region have abundant hours of sun. They also have very windy coastlines. That means that they're well-suited to produce solar and wind energy, and they tend to receive investment from both the West and China. So countries there could be a real winner from the green transition.
Thanks very much, Shilan. I'll make sure to post your report on the green transition on the podcast page. But before you go, I wanted to change topics completely and ask you about India's election, which takes place later this month. You've got a pretty bullish view on India's economy, both in the short term and the longer term. Can you explain to us how the election feeds into that view?
Yeah, of course. Well, in a year of big elections, this is probably the biggest of all, up to a billion people eligible to vote. It's going to take place over 7 weeks from middle of April up until the beginning of June. It looks like, well, all the signs are pointing to another pretty convincing win for Prime Minister Modi's BJP. But really, which party wins the election probably matters less for the economy and financial markets than whether the election delivers a stable government with a working majority in parliament. And we think that another single party majority or even a durable coalition would set the stage for continued gradual structural reforms that would sustain pretty strong rates of growth over the coming years.
That was Shilan Shah on the Indian election and EMs and the green transition. On India, we'll be holding a drop-in. That's one of our short-form webinars on the 11th of April. I'll post details about that on the podcast page, along with some of our key analysis on the outlook for India's economy. We'll have much more to say about India's economy and the election as voting gets underway. Look out for our written analysis, online briefings, and data offerings to help you get a better sense of the economy's near to long-term challenges and opportunities. Now, one of the pain points around EM investing has long been the difficulty in spotting whether cracks are appearing in their balance sheets or whether they're really recovering from financial problems. We've worked with clients to understand what they need to get better insights into financial risks across the EM world. And the outcome of that collaboration is our EM Financial Risk Indicators, a proprietary interactive data set which shows whether financial risks are developing across banking, currency, and the sovereign debt channels in the largest 50 or so emerging markets. These indicators launched late last month, and my colleague Jason Tuvey sat down with Liam Peach, who led this project, to talk through how these indicators help investors and what they're currently saying about where the risks lie in EMs. Here's that conversation now, and it begins with Liam discussing the genesis of these tools.
The backdrop is one in which there's been a particularly large re-emergence of EM risk in the past few years. We've seen COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine cause balance of payment strains across the EM world. These intensified as US interest rates surged and the dollar strengthened. I think past few years, a number of EMs have experienced particularly large currency depreciations, and many EM governments have defaulted on their foreign debts since 2020. So I think that's the backdrop. What we've done is that we've looked at major EM currency, banking, and sovereign debt crises since 1985, The approach we've used to create these indicators is to identify variables, macroeconomic variables, that behave a certain way before a crisis, and identify thresholds or tipping points for those variables that, when crossed, materially increase the risk of a crisis. So some of the variables will be familiar to most people. These include foreign currency reserves, current account balance, capital inflows, debt ratios, for example. The variables and thresholds have been selected because they feature in the majority of past crisis events and they minimize the number of wrong or false signals. In other words, we've only selected the very best variables at identifying emerging signs of a crisis. We've created these indicators for more than 50 emerging markets. So these are all of the largest emerging markets that we cover, as well as a number of frontier markets. We've created these indicators to identify currency, banking, and sovereign risk. So there's three elements of risk across these emerging markets. As I explain in the report, there are lots of ways to use these indicators. I think one of the most important is simply to assess where the risk of a crisis is greatest across the EM world. We classify EMs as high risk of a crisis if they satisfy a number of criteria, and one of those is if the risk indicator rises above a certain level. I think it's also useful to use these indicators to assess which three types of risk, currency, banking, or sovereign, are highest at any one point in time for a country, and how vulnerable different emerging markets might be to external shocks. So hopefully that gives it a nice flavour of what we've created.
That all sounds really good, and hopefully it should go a long way to helping us and also our clients identify key risks in the emerging world. I know you've done some rigorous testing of these indicators. I mean, historically, how well would they have captured past EM crises, and where are they flashing red now?
Yeah, generally, they have been very good at detecting past crises. Our testing has found that more than 70% of crises happen once our indicator goes above our optimal risk threshold. Our currency and banking risk indicators flashed red in parts of emerging Asia, so Korea, Indonesia, Thailand, as early as Q4 1995. In Eastern Europe, our indicator showed very high banking risk in the Baltic states, Hungary, Ukraine in 2006. And our risk indicators also signaled high sovereign debt risk in Sri Lanka, Ghana, Tunisia, and Pakistan in 2019. In terms of EM risk right now, I think it's worth mentioning that EM risk has declined over the past year. Our indicator showed a big rise in fiscal risk in 2020 and 2021, followed by a big increase in currency risk in 2022 as external imbalances worsened. Those currency risks have fallen a long way since then. Current account deficits have narrowed sharply, for example. Overall financial risk is a lot lower now than it was a year ago, but we still identify some pockets of risk. Currency risk remains very high in Turkey and Argentina. Fiscal risks remain concentrated in a number of frontiers that have already defaulted, as well as the likes of Egypt, Tunisia, and Kenya.
Yeah, great. I mean, you mentioned Turkey there, which I guess stands out particularly given the fact we've had this policy shift in Turkey recently, and that still seems to be sticking, at least for the time being, and there's quite a lot of optimism about the country. How do you square sort of the fact that on your risk indicators, Turkey still looks quite risky versus this general optimism about the country's prospects?
Yeah, you're right. Turkey does look risky from a currency crisis point of view, not necessarily from a fiscal or banking perspective at this moment, but it does look pretty risky still from a currency risk standpoint. The central bank's monetary tightening cycle has been very aggressive since the policy shift started in mid-2023. It's been fairly encouraging to us. We saw large capital inflows into Turkey at the end of last year. Credit spreads have narrowed a lot. We do take a fairly optimistic view on Turkey's policy shift, particularly for the medium term. But one thing that we've highlighted in our research is that this policy shift is not going to be easy. The task of bringing inflation down sustainably and improving Turkey's balance of payments position will take time. I think Turkey is likely to remain at high risk of a currency crisis potentially for a few more years. And I think it's going to take a while for Turkey's currency risk indicator to fall. I think what this emphasizes more than anything is the need for policymakers to keep the policy shift on track and to sustain investor confidence given the imbalances that are still in Turkey's economy. If I come back to you, Jason, one country that I've mentioned that shows up as high currency and sovereign debt risk on our indicators is Egypt. So Egypt has been high risk for a while, but a lot has happened in Egypt recently, including the deal with the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund. How do you now assess these risks in Egypt?
Yes, good point. I think in Egypt, we've certainly seen a lot happen recently. Like you mentioned, the deal with the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, ADQ, that's been absolutely key in allowing Egypt to secure some foreign currency. So overall, the deal was about $35 billion. We know already it had received about $10 billion of that within a matter of days of the deal being signed. And ultimately, that's paved the way for Egypt to push ahead with a devaluation. I know from our understanding, officials are really concerned about pushing ahead with that devaluation without the backing of a stock of foreign currency. So we had the Masel-Hekma deal. That's been followed quite quickly by a devaluation, a large interest rate hike, and also an enhanced IMF deal. So I think overall, that's helped to really reduce the balance of payment strains in Egypt. Key, obviously, now is that they do follow through on their pledge for a fully flexible exchange rate. Still early days on that front, so we'll have to see how that pans out over the coming weeks and months. But if they do follow through on that, there does seem, similar to Turkey really, there's quite a lot of optimism now that Egypt is at a turning point, things are going to improve. And ultimately, this also feeds through into the sovereign debt position. The fact that they've secured these foreign currency funds will allow Egypt to meet its external debt obligations over the coming years. We'd always downplayed somewhat the sovereign debt risks in Egypt. In particular, we've highlighted that they were running a primary budget surplus. So once they got the devaluation out of the way, they did secure capital inflows and foreign currency on the back of that. Then ultimately, the tight fiscal position would allow the debt ratio to quickly get back on a downwards trajectory. Yeah, so far, we're still comfortable in that view. I guess actually Egypt contrasts with another country you mentioned, which is Tunisia, where actually things are moving in the wrong direction. We've been highlighting Tunisia for some time now as a default risk. And we've recently seen the president there has sacked the central bank governor, and it looks like they're going down the route of deficit monetization, which from the experience of other EMs, we know that's really not the path to go down, and even more so in Tunisia when you've got very high foreign currency debts. So I think that is one, like you say, is flashing red on your indicators and one we're extremely concerned about. Liam, I was going to say, Austin, we've talked a lot here about things that are flashing red in EMs right now. Are there actually any areas on your indicators where actually the risks are quite low? We should actually take some comfort.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the main area where we'd point to would be banking risk. No country that we cover is currently flashing red as high risk of a banking crisis. In fact, our EM aggregate banking risk indicator is currently around the lowest levels it's been in the past two decades. So banking risks are very low. No major emerging market has experienced particularly big credit or lending boom, which typically precede banking crises in the past. EM banks are not borrowing heavily from abroad in foreign currency. This was a particular problem in parts of Central and Eastern Europe before the banking crisis there in 2008. I think more broadly as well, EM banks are well capitalized, they're profitable. So there's a lot of strength in the EM banking sector. There are some areas to watch in parts of Latin America, Brazil, for example, Chile. There are some countries where interest rates have risen particularly sharply in the past year and lending growth has been fairly strong in recent years. But in general, the picture is pretty good for EM banks and risks are quite low. I'd probably go as far to say that the banking sector is really one of the real pillars of strength in the EM world at the moment.
Yeah, I was just going to add on to that. I think one country where some banking risks are sort of starting to flare up a little, not to any significant degree, but one we should keep an eye on is South Africa. We've obviously seen a few banks recently start to report rising non-performing loans, I guess reflecting the weakness of the economy, particularly over the past year or so. So that's something to keep an eye on.
Jason Tuvey there, speaking with Liam Peach about our new EM financial risk indicators. There's an in-depth report introducing these tools, which I'll put on the podcast page. But for the full interactive experience, including data that you can input directly into your workflow, you'll want CE Advance. That's our premium platform, and you can find details on our website at capitaleconomics.com/CE-advance. But that's it for this week, the end of the EM Takeover. Order will be restored and Neil and David will be back next week. In the meantime, you can find all our EM coverage and much more on our website. The EM team will be back on the podcast very soon with more on the big stories in EM investing, as well as those that aren't getting nearly enough attention. But until next time, goodbye.
Whilst this podcast is provided with all reasonable skill and care, it comprises the subjective views of our economists. Furthermore, these views are not opinions, nor do they constitute investment or financial advice, or are they guarantees or reassurances to the expected results of any investment products or outcome. You should seek your own specific advice in relation to questions you may have. We will have no liability to you in relation to this podcast whatsoever.